Good afternoon. I'm going to call the Tax Committee to order, and I'm going to go by, we're first going to finish the testimony on the estate and gift, and we're going to start with Ms. Cadoon, if she can join us. And we heard that Mr. Peterson does not want to testify, so that's Ms. Cadoon plus, I think, two or three more folks. So welcome to the committee, Ms. Cadoon. Back to the estate and gift.
Right. Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Beth Cadoon. I represent the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce. I certainly appreciate you allowing us to follow up on the estate and gift tax testimony from yesterday. You did hear from one of our members at the very end of committee, which was a CPA who works in this field. And what you heard from him is what we heard, similar stories from around the state from other CPAs, financial planners, which is really the kind of great increase in interest and requests from their customers regarding how you relocate out of Minnesota. And this is similar to what we heard as we went around the state on our policy development, which we do every interim, to ask how can we make Minnesota more competitive, how can we improve the business climate. And after the business-to-business tax, which we appreciate you addressing in your bill, we heard a great concern regarding from our membership regarding, I think it's really the trifecta of the three taxes. So the new fourth tier on the 9.85%, the gift tax being enacted, Minnesota, one of two states with the gift tax, and then the estate tax. And as was mentioned by the chair, that still remains at the $1 million level. Why we think this has become more and more of an issue is because the federal estate tax was in such flux for many years. And finally, in 2012, they did settle on a number of $5 million threshold. And in the meantime, other states have made changes to their estate tax and continue to do that. We had a couple other states last year that I believe are phasing out their estate tax. We've had Governor Cuomo of New York as part of his tax proposal. And New York is one of the other states that's still at that $1 million threshold. His package of $2 billion of tax reductions, he does propose to do the estate tax in New York, increase it to the federal threshold of, you know, 5 million indexed to inflation, as well as reducing the rate to 10%. So as you see, more and more states are acting on this. We think Minnesota is becoming more and more of a tax outlier. And the one study I wanted to bring to your attention was a study by the Connecticut Department of Revenue. Connecticut is the other state that has the gift tax. And when they did a study, they asked their respondents that had moved out of the state the reason for that. And over half said that it was the estate and gift tax was a major factor in why they moved out of Connecticut. So like I said, those are the stories we are hearing from members, and you heard from the CPA yesterday. Another reason I think the committee should consider is with the demographic shift that is occurring with more and more of the baby boomers entering the retirement years, we think this is becoming more and more of an issue. As they get out of the workforce, that they are more mobile. A lot of them have in second homes in states that do not have income tax or an estate tax. And we strongly recommend that the committee act on this. We certainly appreciate the bipartisan authors to repeal the gift tax. We think that's very important. We encourage you to, if you can't eliminate the estate tax, which would be our preference, to join the 36 other states that do not have an estate tax. We recommend moving to at least that federal threshold. We think that would greatly help. We also think that would really help the administrative burden in trying to deal with this estate and gift tax. Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much, Ms. Cadoon, and thanks for waiting until today. I see Ms. Madden is here, and Mr. Hickey just walked in. So, Ms. Madden, if you want to join us, and then we'll go to Mr. Hickey. And we really appreciate folks waiting to finish off the testimony. So welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Nan Madden. I'm director of the Minnesota Budget Project. There's no doubt that there are technical problems with Minnesota's estate and gift taxes, which add to complexity and confusion for taxpayers. They refer to old sections of federal tax law, they're not unified, and there's the rate bubble. We would encourage you that as you address those concerns, you prioritize minimizing the loss of revenue and not adding regressivity to the state's tax system. And I want to thank Chair Lencheski for following that kind of approach in her bill. Last year's tax reform bill made important strides in making the tax system less regressive. But low and moderate income Minnesotans still pay a higher share of their incomes in state and local taxes than the wealthiest Minnesotans. We think that continuing to chip away at the regressivity of the tax system should continue to be a priority for tax decisions this year, and large cuts to the estate tax would take us in the opposite direction. A second concern we have is the size of many of the proposed estate tax bills, and especially the fact that their cost tends to grow substantially in the next biennium. So, for example, House File 2464 has a $240 million fiscal impact in the 16-17 biennium. We have just come through more than a decade of frequent budget deficits, and while our new forecast includes some good news, much of that positive balance is not money in the bank, but projections, and projections for the next biennium are even more uncertain. So nobody can predict the future exactly, so I think we should be cautious about taking on large commitments in the next biennium. Thank you for the opportunity to testify, and I again encourage you to resolve the technical problems in the estate tax following the priorities of minimizing the loss of revenue and minimizing the impact of fairness on the system.
Thank you so much, Ms. Mann. Thanks again for waiting. Mr. Yep. Hickey, thank you also for being willing to come back, finish off our estate and gift, and after that we have Mr. Busselman, and we'll move to all the tax credits. Nice to see you, Mr. Hickey.
Absolutely, Madam Chair, and thanks for the time you're giving to this important issue. I really appreciate it. Mike Hickey with the National Federation of Independent Business, represent over 13,000 small businesses, and been very involved in this issue for a long time. Our biggest concern with our new gift tax is we think there's legitimate concerns it's going to cause a tremendous amount of tax avoidance. And wealthier Minnesotans who can gift at these levels are a lot more, and who are already spending 3-4 months, 5 months a year outside the state, I think there's going to be a very strong incentive for them to stay just a little bit longer, dot the I's, cross the T's, and seriously look at changing a residence. I believe in the long run, we're going to get very little revenue out of that taxpayer. And this will cause a lot of tax avoidance and switching of residences. I think the people we will get the money out of, unfortunately, are going to be the people we represent, the small businesses and the farms who can't move, whose assets are grounded, pretty much grounded here, have to stay here. That's where the business and the farm is. There's no option to liquidate that enterprise, take the money to another state and avoid this. And that's our big concern, frankly. And, you know, we do appreciate the progress we made on the small business farm carve-out, and that certainly helps. It has some limitations to it, but it's a good step forward. The problem with this law, it gets directly in the way of trying to plan generational transfer of small businesses and farms. And parents would like to do this while they're still around. They'd like to get their adult children involved in this when they're younger versus older, and this really gets in the way of doing that. You run into this tax, and that is our biggest concern, and you're going to be paying 10% of what you're trying to transfer above your exemptions. And so that is really the concern. It throws open the option of setting up elaborate trusts and going down the road to some of the things Mr. Michael discussed yesterday, but we'd much rather have a simpler tax code and not having to occur that amount of legal work and attorney work. So I appreciate the time you're dedicating this today. I want to seriously urge you to repeal this new tax that we're just getting started on, and those are our concerns.
Okay, thank you so much, Mr. Hickey. I appreciate you coming back today.
Oh, absolutely.
Thanks so much. Is Mr. Busselman here? I don't see him. Okay, if not, we're going to move on to the other items, and that should wrap up estate and gift. And we're going to start with Representative Dabney, who has the micro distillery tax credit.
Hi.
And members, we have a few bills today that we don't technically have possession of because they haven't left other people's committees yet, but they're all tax bills that need to get here if they're going to be enacted into law. But we want to hear all the tax credits today together. Representative Dabney.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'd like to move House File 1826 to be before the Committee for Possible Inclusion in the Omnibus.
Representative Dabney moves 1826, and you do not have an amendment, right?
I do not. No.
Okay, great. Thanks.
All right. Thank you very much. Good afternoon, members. I know in this committee there's a tradition of first-time authors bringing treats. I am not a first-time author before this committee, and I'm not sure that the Speaker would view favorably my providing treats from the good people who are with me here today. But
Madam Chair. Madam Chair, good thing the Speaker is not in charge of this committee and this committee is, right? So
we will not be drinking during this.
Madam Chair, are we on TV today?
I don't know. Either way, we're not drinking.
Either way, all right. Committee. All right.
Representative Dabney.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Last year, the legislature looked hard and long at adjusting alcohol taxes in the state, affecting all different forms of alcohol in different ways. We ended up stepping back from any of those except increasing the credit that we provide brewers on beer. It's now $4.60 in tax credit per barrel up to 25,000 barrels or 26,000 barrels per year for breweries. And that's an attempt to provide some space through the tax code for small breweries to develop. And they certainly have in Minnesota in just the last few years. A place where Minnesota lags now in the new craft alcohol food and beverage movement is micro distilleries. I say we lag now because there's a great deal of excitement around the state in micro distilleries. I've got one that's opening, I think, soon in my district. They post photos on their Facebook page about what's coming in, what equipment is coming in, and how they're doing, but also across the state. This bill asks for a credit of $1.33 per liter for these micro distillers. It would also provide them the opportunity to not pay taxes on the samples that they are allowed to provide people touring or visiting the distillery. We increased the amount that they can provide as samples last year to 15 milliliters a sample and up to 45 milliliters a visit. I have no idea how much that is. But I do have with me a couple of testifiers, Madam Chair, and I'd like to start with Ms. Montana.
Thank you so
welcome
much.
To the committee.
Thank you, Chairwoman, and thank you, Representative Dabney. We're really excited to be here. I am the president of the Micro Distillers Guild for the state of Minnesota, and we have approximately 20 members who are in the process of either investing or have invested hundreds of thousands of dollars, if not millions of dollars, into the Minnesota economy in the form of a micro distillery. And we span all over the state from Duluth, Halleck, Minnesota, up by the border, and in Waconia in the suburbs. We have four distillers actually here with us from St. Paul. I myself am from Minneapolis, Isanti, and Waconia. So we are really excited to be here. And like Representative Dabney said, what we are asking for today is just the minimum threshold to be a micro distiller is 20,000 gallons in your production per year, which is a very, very small amount, and that equates to the tax excise tax exemption that we are asking for this year. So it is a very small amount. It's just to get our members off on the ground running and make sure that they are able to really make their business grow, and it does equate to a very similar amount that the brewers and the wineries are also given. And so we're looking at this as really parity for micro distilleries. I myself am the owner of Denord Craft Spirits out of Minneapolis. We are bringing in a lot of the local agriculture into our shop. We are really trying to make as much as we can local, and I think that really is emphasizing a lot of what micro distillers are doing. And so not only is this going to be affecting our shop, but an excise tax exemption like this will affect the entire supply chain and help us to do business and really get our shop up and running. So with that, I'll turn it over to...
Thank you for your testimony. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you. My name is Rick Schneider, and I'm from Isani Spirits in Isani, Minnesota, which is, oddly enough, the last dry county in Minnesota after Prohibition. And when I decided to move to that county and build my business, I had a lot of people tell me I was crazy because they didn't think the county would allow it. But they've been very excited and drafted ordinances to allow not only breweries but wineries and distilleries to open in that county. It's one of the main goals of these businesses is not only to enrich the lives of our families, but also to enrich the lives of the counties in which we live. My county particularly is actually one that is seeing a decline in agriculture currently. And all of these businesses, and especially distilleries, we're an ag-related business. We use grain. Almost all of us in our organization are making direct deals with farmers very close to us to remain as green as we can and to provide benefits to more people around us. Any tax break that gives us a chance to hire another person, to be more competitive, gives us a chance to grow all of those businesses for all the rural areas as well as those in the cities. And that's all I'd like to add. Thank you for your
time. Thank you, Mr. Schneider. Anyone else who would like to speak for or against this bill? We unfortunately have 11 bills on the calendar. We're trying to not have to come back tonight. So welcome to the committee.
Thank you very much. I'm Robert McManus, founder of the 11 Wells Distillery and the formerly vacant Ham Brewery over on the east side. I'm here to testify that if you pass this revenue neutral bill, you'll add a very important ingredient to the creation of craft spirits. That is some of this tax reform and reducing our costs during the startup phase of this business, which is our substantial costs. Similar reductions have helped wineries and breweries, and I think it's very logical to conclude that something like this will absolutely help grow a micro-distilling industry here in the state. Finally, this is going to create jobs and revenue in the future as we grow. My distillery is less than 10 minutes away from here, and you're welcome to visit and see the impact that we're having in this formerly vacant area. Finally, in conjunction with St. Paul's STAR program, the mayor, I've invested over $600,000, part of that from City of St. Paul's STAR program, and passage of this will allow me to put some of that money back into the business in equipment or hiring employees sooner than I'm forecasting currently. With that, thank you for your attention.
Thank you. Was it Mr. McManus or McDaniels?
McManus.
McManus. Thank you for being here. Anyone else would like to testify for or against this bill? Anything from the committee? If not, we're going to lay your bill over for possible inclusion in the omnibus tax bill. Representative Dabney.
Thank you very much, ma'am.
Thank you. And I don't see Representative Rosenthal. A lot of people are going back and forth between jobs committee and this one. The Angel Credit Group has asked us to wait for them, so we'll go to Representative Anderson, if that's okay, first. And when we see Representative Rosenthal, we can go back. And Representative Anderson, you have a couple, and I'm trying to see.
Madam Chair.
These are both here.
Madam Chair, Bob Gracie with Minnesota Council of Accommodations. And Representative Rosenthal, since he is going back and forth, and I'm happy to present later, but he did ask, since this is just for informational purposes, if it works out for the committee that I just present the bill on his behalf.
Sure, we could do that. If he doesn't want to be here, we know he's in another committee, but he was going to come back.
I'm happy to have Representative Anderson move forward.
Okay,
but I want
we'll go on to Representative Anderson in case Representative Rosenthal shows up. So Representative Anderson has a couple members, and she can move them herself. And it looks like they both have amendments, and we're in possession of them both, right? Aren't we? Can you check? Okay. Great. Now, are these both... Okay. Great. Representative Anderson. I was just trying to figure out if one of them was an angel, because we want to take that as a cluster and testimony on that as a cluster. So,
sure.
And all the angel credit people are also in the jobs committee right now, so they will be coming down later. So, Representative Anderson, how would you like to start?
No angels here, but we have good people nonetheless. Members of the committee, if I could, I'm going to move both of the bills, Madam Chair. Is
sure.
that right?
So, which one are you moving first here, just formally?
We will do the sole proprietor one, House File 1963.
Okay, so that's moved before the committee.
And then also House File 2015.
And I think, Representative Anderson, you have an amendment on the 1963, right?
I do. And actually, that was just kind of a drafting error. And if you wish, I think Ms. Manzi could walk you through that if you need.
I don't think we need that if members are willing to get it in the form Representative Anderson would like. So on the A1, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed say nay. The A1 is adopted. So now we've got 1963 before us.
Okay.
That was a number. And the other one?
House File 2015, Madam Chair.
So Representative Anderson moves House File 2015, and we have a note that you have an A1 there as well.
Yes.
So members, to get in the form Representative Anderson would like, all those in favor of the A1, say aye. Aye. Opposed, say nay. The A1 is adopted. Okay. Representative Anderson, thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, members. I have with me today Scott Schmidt and Mark Gross. That I'm going to leave it to them to talk about this. The first bill that we're going to talk about is the extending the research and development tax credit to sole proprietors. That's something that we currently don't do in the state of Minnesota. And I asked the research department of why we don't do it, and they said we're not really quite sure. We have some good fail-safes in place to make sure that we protect that the money is being used properly. But they can talk to you about why it's important to them. So I'll hand it over to them.
Okay, great. Mr. Gross or Mr. Schmidt, who wants to start?
Mr. Gross is starting first.
Great, thank you. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you for having me. My name is Mark Gross, and I'm the sole proprietor, owner, and chief executive officer of Formacoat LLC. I started Formacoat 12 years on my own. It's bootstrapped and organically grown, and right now I have 10 employees, but in 2010 I had 20, had a few issues. The only reason we're alive today is the research and development that we've done, and which now represents about greater than 50% of our revenue. But I came to understand for the 2012 tax year that as a sole proprietor, I'm not allowed to get the same credit that all the other corporation types are supposed to get. And I'm a real company. You know, it's not like, I don't know why, it is what it is, but over the 12 years, a vast majority of my revenue has gone as exports to other countries. We help large companies, major international medical device companies, to small local companies. From here, I go to a meeting with a doctor and two of his sidekicks, where their startup medical device company is their night job, and we do research and development for them, and it hopefully will turn into a huge deal for them and for us and for the state of Minnesota. But it turns out that as a sole proprietor, I'm not allowed to have the same rights or opportunity to have a tax credit that all the other corporation types are able to have. And then secondarily, with regard to the other bill, can I just mention my one bit there? And that's
sure, please, that, refundable credit.
That, if it were a not just a credit, but the potential for a refundable, it helps a small company like mine tremendously because it shortens the delay time between you know when you do the work and when you get a small. It's a token amount of assistance given the overall picture, but it helps and I hope that both of these would be retroactive. Because these activities that I've been doing have been since 2010, but it was only in 2012 that I was found wanting because I was now a sole proprietorship.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Cross.
Thank
appreciate
you.
That very much. And Mr. Schmidt, did you want to address both bills as well? Or you're conferring? I see that. We can wait.
I'll hold off on this until the next bill.
And after we're done with Mr. Gross and Mr. Madam Schmidt, Chair? We'll see if there's anyone else. Yes,
thank
please.
Thank you, Madam Chair, for your patience.
Sure.
Scott Schmidt is going to comment, I think, more so on the second bill, but also a little bit on the first bill, too.
Okay, great.
Right. Okay, well,
great.
Thanks for having me here today. This
sure.
is my first time ever testifying, so this is exciting. My name's Scott Schmidt, and I live in Minneapolis, and I am part owner of two businesses that have interest in the Minnesota State R&D Tax Credit. One of them is a software development business, and the second is a consulting business that helps companies take advantage of the R&D tax credit.
Okay, like such Mr. As, Gross here, I see
such,
that.
Such as
nice.
Mr. Gross, and
okay.
I'm not sure how much everybody knows about the R&D tax credit, but there's a federal credit, and then less than 40 states have state R&D tax credits as well. And I'm here today to ask you to once again make the Minnesota credit one of the best in the country. You may know Minnesota was the first state to have a state R&D tax credit. Over the years, many states instituted their own state credits, and as time went on, Minnesota's credit became very average as compared to other states in the country, other credits. In 2010, the state of Minnesota took some incredible steps and made the credit credit rocketed up to the top as one of the best in the country. We doubled the value of it. We made it available to almost all entities except sole proprietors, and we made it refundable. As you know, And as you've heard, that refundable aspect of the credit, meaning companies can still get a tax refund even if they don't have a tax liability, and if they can't use the credits, they still have the ability to get a refund from the state. And for companies like Mark's, which are, you know, day to day trying to figure out sometimes how they're going to pay the bills, any amount of cash is very important to them. So I'm here to ask you, first of all, to consider making the credit refundable again. Many states in the country currently are looking to improve their state credits. If you're like me, I'm sure you're not, but I get Google alerts about the R&D tax credit. Every day I get Google alerts about states that are looking to strengthening their R&D tax credits. For 2013, as you know, Minnesota took away that refundable aspect. So the ability for companies like Mark's or other companies to get a refund, get that cash back in their pockets so that they can hire people, is no longer available. There are other states that have very, very good credits that are now better than ours because we took away that refundable aspect. Iowa has a refundable credit. In North Dakota, small companies up to a certain size can sell their credits. If they can't, they can monetize it by selling it. Pennsylvania, in my mind, which is has one of the best in the country now, and I like to compare Minneapolis-St. Paul to Pittsburgh. The cities are very alike from a quality of living standpoint, technology, culture, and so forth. In Pennsylvania, you can sell the credit there as well, but they're not limited to the small companies. Companies of any size can sell their state credit, monetize those credits right away, and put cash in their pocket. So, again, I would like to ask the committee to consider reinstating that refundable aspect, because companies like Mark's that are truly doing R&D, are in a growth phase, can surely use that money. The second way that I would like to ask you to consider improving the credit is to make it easier to actually apply for. I don't want to get into how the credit is calculated, but the Minnesota credit calculation mimics the federal rules. And the rules require you to establish a baseline of spending, which that baseline is a percentage of qualified spending to sales. So you establish that base from back to some point in time when your company was started, and then you look to your more recent years and you try to show that you were spending more R&D, because it's a credit for increasing research. Well, the federal rules and the Minnesota rules require older companies, meaning companies that were either around in the mid-80s or prior, to go back and provide support or documentation back to the mid-80s. So as you probably can imagine, a lot of companies didn't even have computers back in the mid-80s, let alone project tracking, time tracking. So if some of these companies, say there's a company today, a precision machining company, multi-generational business, it's been around for 40 years, they find out about the R&D tax credit, they want to apply for it, and they suddenly have to come up with documentation from 1984 to 1988. You can imagine that would be pretty tough for them to do. And many of the other states around the country have credits that only require you to look at your prior 3 or 4 years in order to do the math. So it's much easier for those companies to provide the support, and they're not at risk. Some of you may know when Minnesota made the credit refundable back in 2010, the State Department of Revenue upped their activity around audits, and a lot of those audits would ask older companies to go back and supply data from 1984 to 1988. Very tough to do for a lot of those companies. So they're penalized because they're older companies, and that's probably not right. So I'd like to ask the committee to also consider looking at the rules for how the Minnesota state credit is calculated.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Schmidt. Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And just to wrap it up, just a couple of things. You know, I'm not going to say too much about Iowa, but it's a sad state of affairs when we're being compared negatively to Iowa. But that said, I think a little nugget for you guys to know, we look to DEED because they are the agency that works on creating jobs here in the state of Minnesota, and in trying to help businesses create jobs here in the state of Minnesota. And when we got rid of the refundability in the 2013 tax bill, DEED was still advertising the refundability portion that we used to have as late as October 13th. So we know it's a tool that was useful to them in trying to get companies to either stay here in the state of Minnesota or to actually come and be here in the state of Minnesota. And we know that their job is challenging enough, and so it would be nice to be able to allow them to keep that nugget on their website, bring it back and put it on their website so that they can keep helping businesses create more jobs here in the state. So with that, I appreciate the time that you've granted us.
Thank you, Representative Anderson. Is there anyone else who'd like to speak for or against this legislation? Yes, please, come on up. And I should just say, as the next testifier is coming up, I appreciate the testimony, Mr. Schmidt and Mr. Gross. I will tell you, just to be straight up and honest with you about the refundability, which Mr. Gross also mentioned, is I was the author of the bill that made that refundable and doubled that. And then when we went into a deficit, I was also the person responsible for undoing the refundability. And just to be honest with you, you know, facing what we were all looking at, we were putting $83 million a year into refundability, so to Minnesota companies that weren't paying state tax. And it just seemed at the pressure time for all of us that, you know, to try to provide tax preferences to folks who had no Minnesota liability was kind of a tough sell. I do think we were nation-leading in getting to refundability, and Representative Anderson has been a huge leader on pushing us to continue to work on the research and development credit. So, you know, while I don't really have an opinion on what happens next, I just wanted you to know kind of how it came about and kind of how it went away. And it's simply a budgetary item. So I hear you, and that $83 million, of course, did not include sole proprietors because they, as we've all heard, don't qualify. But it's just, you know, it's a piece of information for you to know as to how expensive that was getting for the state to continue to have that. And I understand the other side of the argument is, but it creates jobs, and I get that. So I just wanted to be honest about kind of where it's been, and trust me, Representative Anderson keeps us all on top of this issue. So
sure. Well, and I appreciate that. Thank you. And I guess what I'll offer is, because we're local, because we work with companies all across the country on pursuing the R&D tax credit, I can probably, you know, provide some perspective on what other states are doing. So I'd be happy to be a resource for you, because there's a lot of opportunity.
And it may be back. You know, and I should say, in all fairness, I mean, when I said I authored that, I mean, Representative Anderson had many bills at that time. We called it the 2010 Jobs Bill. It was a tax bill that had a myriad of tax cuts for all kinds of businesses and did things like the Angel Credit, which we'll hear about later today. But it was a compilation of a lot of legislators working hard to provide some of those, and we've had to take a second look.
I understand. And the last thing, and I'll get out of here, just as you're thinking about this again, I will tell you, and I don't know why Mark is set up as a sole proprietor, but I will tell you, there are very, very few sole proprietors out there that are looking to pursue the R&D tax credit. So if you're considering this, trust me, it's not going to be a big dent to the R&D. It's going to be like a pimple. It's going to be really small as far as a hit to the budget. It's unusual to see sole proprietors who have as many employees as he has.
Thank you so much. Brilliant. And you did a great job for the first time being here.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you so much. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Shay Mandel. I'm with Life Science Alley, and I will be very brief. I think you're all well-versed on the refundability, the impact that it's had. Just a couple of quick comments. Again, Life Science Alley, we represent 700 organizations here in Minnesota that employ almost 300,000 of our citizens, heavy R&D-focused medical device companies, pharmaceutical companies, research entities like the University of Minnesota, as well as Mayo. And we're very supportive of returning to refundability. As has been previously stated, this was a mechanism that really provided Minnesota with an opportunity to attract a lot of attention. And I'll just give you a couple of statistics, and I think this is relevant also to the conversation around the angel investor tax credit. In somewhat of a troubling time around healthcare and investments in life sciences, in 2010, there was $217 million invested in life science companies in Minnesota. By 2013, that number was up to $341 million. So if I were to have an appeal to the committee, as you think about where to invest state dollars in this legislative session, these programs are working. So incenting early stage investment through the Angel Investor Tax Credit Program, the refundability piece that really increased R&D investment, made acquisitions and investments in early stage companies far more attractive. We almost doubled the investment in life science businesses during the last 3 years, and I would submit to you it is a product of these programs. So with that, Madam Chair, committee members, thank you for your time, and again, we're really supportive of returning to refundability.
Great. Thanks for your testimony. Others? No one else? Okay. Thank you, Representative Anderson. With that, we're going to lay both of those over for possible inclusion of the omnibus tax bill. And we have Representative Rosenthal next. He's not here. And then I was going to go to Earhart, who just walked in. We can take Representative Earhart's bill right now. Representative Earhart, if you're able to join us at the table. Then I don't see Savick or Grunhag and all the Grun. She is. Okay, good. And, oh, there. I was going to say, I saw him come in. So we'll get to you two next. Okay, so Representative Earhart now moves House File 1955 to be before the committee for possible inclusion in the omnibus tax bill. Representative Earhart.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This bill allows taxpayers to. There is a 529 affair we have in the state that you can contribute money to for college education. It accrues tax interest. It has interest. Whatever the growth is in the plan, you don't get taxed at it, provided at the end of the time it's used for post-secondary approved education. This bill would allow deduction for the contribution, and it limits the contribution to $5,000 for each qualified beneficiary. And then in the overview there, it talks about married taxpayer in the top bracket, that this would result in a maximum state tax savings of $985, and that is for a $10,000 contribution. That's just a shot at this. There are many, I don't know if you guys have got this, I think so, Madam Chair, the House Research Bill Summary, but on the back, two pages of that, there's a. It shows the various states and the amount that they contribute. Some are deductible, and I think some are not. And Maine has $100,000. you want to go to Maine, you could take care of dumping a lot more money. It's one of those wonderful places that we could use to stash some money away to help college. And I think it's very important that we get people putting enough money ahead for college as soon as possible, because otherwise people are getting out with $50,000 worth of debt, and that's not a good idea for our society ongoing. Questions?
Do you have any testifiers? Anybody in the audience who'd like to speak for or against this bill? And I think $50,000 is not even considered that large anymore, Representative right. Earhart. It's really getting out of control. So I think we understand the goal in the bill. Then the chart, I'm sure Ms. Manzi is the one who probably put it together. No, Mr. Michael, it is very interesting, members, in the House summary to see what other states are doing. Anything else? If not, we're going to lay this over for possible inclusion in the omnibus tax bill. Thank you, Representative Earhart. Sure. And we're going to go to Representative Savick and then Grunhagen. The Angel bills all want to go last, so then we'll probably ask Representative Runbeck if she can jump up ahead of them, if that's okay. So Representative Savick, and I see you have some testifiers with you, and I think, members, we are hearing this one informationally because it's in another committee still. Is that right? Yes. So we don't technically have possession, so we're not going to move it or add amendments. We're going to hear it for informational purposes. So that we will have at least gotten it through our docket. Welcome to the committee, Representative Savick. And please, your testifiers, just come on up. We can get you a few more chairs. And so no need to make the motion because we don't technically possess the bill. So please tell us about your legislation.
First, I'd like to thank you for hearing it, and I really appreciate it. This legislation is a $500 grant to volunteer EMS, EMTs, and firefighters and first responders. The reason we're asking for it is that there is a real shortage of firefighters, EMTs in the rural area. I guess it's also in the metropolitan area. But it's leading to issues, and I'd like to discuss the issues. The first is public safety. We had an incident in Frost, Minnesota, a couple of years ago in the summertime, and there was a fire in town. There was not one firefighter there because they were all working out of town, so they had to call another city to come to. And that's a delay, and if there was children in a house or something bad could happen. We also need this for economic development in the rural areas. If you have a business and you want to start a business up, you certainly don't want to start it up where there's minimal fire protection or EMT, emergency services. So it, in addition to that, if the firefighters get a different rating, a higher rating, your insurance for your house can go up. So it's a financial issue for families because insurance rates depend on how fast and how good that firefighters can get to the area. And also for families, being a volunteer firefighter, you have to have the same training as a career firefighter. And basically, it's taking more and more time away from home and and the family because we have hazardous waste now and all kinds of issues that they have to be trained on. So it's very difficult to recruit firefighters. I have with me the president of the Freeborn County Firefighters Association, and I asked him to talk about one big fire they had down there and also the trouble that he's having in recruiting firefighters.
Great, thank you. And thank you so much for being here and for taking time away from your community to join us and appreciate all you're doing. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Madam Chair and committee members, I just found out about this a couple days ago. I've never done this before, so bear with me. I just made a few bullet points that I'll try to hit on and just give you a little background on myself. I'm current chief, even though it says captain here, just ignore that. Small department, we can't afford to buy new shirts. I'm current chief of a township fire department. I'm full-time backup to a paid fire department. I've got 4 years experience in a Worthington fire department, so I've got about 29 years of fire service. I'm president of the Freeborn County Fire Association. That is 16 fire departments that exist down in Freeborn County. We're the oldest fire association in the state of Minnesota. We have met for about 67 years. We meet once a month. We meet with EMS. We meet with fire. We meet with sheriff. We meet with city police. We've been trying to get the highway patrol involved, DNR involved, Red Cross, Salvation Army, the National Guard. We work with all these different entities. If there's anything that ever comes up that we need to talk about, we try to talk about. One of the biggest things that we're doing right now, we're having problems with, is that we've had a real problem retaining firefighters. I've been chief for 5 years now, and I think I've hired probably 15 firefighters. And I know I've lost half of those firefighters. The city fire department, they've hired not as many lately, but in the past they'd hire them, and they'll transfer to a bigger city fire department or another fire department. I was talking with Chief Greg over here a minute ago, and he said his fire department was in Eagan. I mean, they were talking a big city, and they're having trouble retaining firefighters. There's a lot of issues why. When we get these guys on the department, we ask them, are you willing to spend the 4 months of two nights a week for 4 hours for training just to get your fire, then 3 months of training two nights a week just to get your first responder? And if you get in the bigger cities, you're talking paramedic, EMT, it's even more. Are you willing to spend 590 hours a year in continual training, which my department does, plus we have another 800 hours with my city fire department that I train with? Are you willing to commit to the 4 or 5 fundraisers that you need to do as a fire department, because you have no funds coming from your city, you have no funds coming from the state, you get your state aid money, which can only be used for pension or for equipment. These guys that are servicing areas outside of their fire departments, the only funds they're getting there is their money for their territory, and that's probably what's supporting their fire department to buy equipment. So I talked to a couple of the smaller departments the other day, and he says, we do 4 fundraisers a year just to maintain our equipment and to keep the gear on the guys, and they virtually get nothing. So you go to a young guy or gal and tell them you want to be a firefighter for nothing as a service, and it's going to take up 500, 600, 700 hours of your time. That's not counting fires. A lot of our fire departments, they have a little spike in the money they get paid for a fire. So I go to a fire, and the fire could last 3, 4, 5 hours. The one she's talking about up in Hollandale was an all-nighter. I got paid $15. actually, I didn't get paid anything because I'm the chief. I don't get paid. The firefighters got $15. We're there for an hour or there for the day. And many of the fire departments get nothing or something equivalent to that, $5, $10, just something just to keep them tight. So this $500 would be huge to show to a new firefighter that there'd be a tax credit, there'd be a grant, or there'd be something that they could say, here's $500 that I can take my wife out for dinner some night because I missed the birthday party, I missed the Easter party, I missed the Christmas getting together. Many times I've been called out of every one of them. I've been called out of funerals, weddings. And when you're a small department like ours, the pager goes off, you have a responsibility that you got to go. I mean, I run a business, and I've left my business with one employee, and I've taken off and gone to a fire because I felt the severity of the fire needed to have somebody there. So we need the commitment of these young people, and the only way we're going to get that is we have to get something for them to show them that there's a reason to be a firefighter. The insurance, I just got a call last week. There's an insurance company called me, want to know how far away we were from said property, and how long would it take you to respond? And I said, a normal day, 5 to 10 minutes to get to the fire hall, 5 minutes to get to the site. And that's critical to them as to what they're going to charge that person for insurance. Right now, our 16-department area in the county, we have got 4 departments that are seriously contemplating of merging with a department in a town near them, which would put them in a situation where they're going to get charged horrendous tax for their insurance property, because they're not going to have a fire department close enough to take care of them. So it's a real concern. Able and willing to find the young people that we need to do this. I should have retired 5 years ago. I could have retired 5 years ago. And I just felt that there was nobody in our department that was willing to take the chief's job. It's probably a 2-3 hour a day job, even though, you know, I get $100 a month. But there's something that has to always be done. We're getting a call from somebody or something, or something's wrong at the fire hall. We froze the water lane at the fire hall the other day, so we had to go down and work on that. So there's always something. So we need something to get able and willing people to do this and to see that there's going to be something that they're going to get in return for doing it to keep them involved in it. The cost to put a new firefighter on, these guys can attest to that. The training alone, there's been state funds that have taken care of that, thank God. If we had to pay that, that's probably about $700 to $1,500 per firefighter to get them just trained, another $1,500 just to get them in a uniform, and they're virtually 5 years life expectancy of them. So the cost to run fire departments has not gone down. The need is still there. The funds coming in to support some of the training that we do is gradually being taken away from us every year. So this is a critical, critical thing that I think we need to try to pass, and we hope that you folks can see our need and our want for this. And if there's any questions, I'll be glad to try to answer them.
Okay, thanks for your testimony, Chief. You did a great job advocating for not having done this, and I'm going to ask the other two chiefs in the room.
We were talking about, we had 21 fire departments there, okay, and we had over 300 firemen there, but it took us all day to get them there.
Okay,
so
thank you. Thank you. Either of the other chiefs want to jump in here?
Yes.
I'm sorry we're so pressed for time. We still have another 5 bills we're trying to get through today. So welcome to the committee.
Start. Thank you, Madam Chair. Just quickly, George Espenson, I'm the fire chief for the city of Eden Prairie. I'm also the chair for the chief's legislative committee. As you've heard Chief Carl so eloquently talk about, we're at a crisis. Minnesota spends we rank 47th in spending on the fire service in Minnesota. A lot of that is because we have a very robust volunteer system here. 18 of the 20,000 firefighters in the state are paid on call or volunteer, but unfortunately that number continues to drop. And whether you're a big metro department like Bloomington, which is predominantly volunteer, or Eden Prairie, or in greater Minnesota, Albert Lea Township, the issues are very similar, and that is we have shifting demographics, and especially in greater Minnesota we have a shifting kind of economic center issue, which is the few young people that stay in these small towns usually are driving 20, 30 miles to find work, and so during the day there are no firefighters, and at night it's a tremendous kind of commitment. In 2006, I co-chaired a state task force. We went around the state, produced a report, and it talked about this same issue, saw it on the horizon. One of the major components to hopefully help stem the tide a little bit with recruitment and retention was this idea of some sort of a tax incentive. And so we're just kind of circling back on that. And last but not least, there was a great article last week on the front of the opinion section of the Star Tribune on just all the challenges facing greater Minnesota. And this is this is another one, but it's not just Greater Minnesota. It's also the metro departments that have historically relied on paid-on-call or volunteer firefighters. And for that, I'll turn it over to my colleague, Chief Scott from Egan.
Great. Thank you. Welcome, Chief.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mike Scott. I'm the Egan Fire Chief. I've been in the fire service for about 30 years. Egan operates one of the largest paid-on-call fire departments in the state, I think second to Bloomington. We're authorized 150 paid-on-call firefighters or volunteers. We also get paid $15 per call, whether you're there for an hour or for 10 hours. We're like I mentioned, we're authorized 150. Today we have 88 firefighters, which may sound like a lot of firefighters, but at any given time you got to figure that about a third of your firefighting force is available. And during the day I have 18 firefighters, and if you take a third of those, that's not very many to protect a city of 65,000 people. So I lose about 15 volunteers a year. I've lost 140 volunteers in about 10 years. It's just a constant turnover that affects not only our budget cost-wise, but also operational. We have a lot of, about 52% of our department has less than 5 years experience on the department. When we do exit surveys as to why people are leaving, it's the time commitment. I mean, it's huge when you have to train the same as a full-time career department, but it's your extra job or your hobby, and you have kids' events and both spouses working. It's a constant battle. But also it's being underappreciated. A lot of volunteers feel like they're not appreciated, and something like this I think would help a lot by knowing that they're appreciated, by giving them some kind of a tax incentive. Egan recently applied for a SAFER grant, which is a FEMA grant. It's staffing adequately for staffing adequately for emergency response. We got the grant. We ranked number 6 out of the 1,500 applications nationwide. When I talked to the FEMA coordinator, she said Minnesota always just stuns the review board because we have such big cities that have volunteer departments still today. So we get a 2-year grant to hire 5 full-time people to help us cover day coverage, but then after that, what do? It's about $400,000 just for those five firefighters. If we were to hire a full-time force like our neighboring department of Burnsville, it's $3 million a year. And as you all know, with competing interest right now, to find $3 million in a city of Egan's size to fund a full-time department isn't going to happen. So again, in summary, I think one of the main things that this wouldn't be the answer to all of our problems, but it would sure help it to make the volunteers feel appreciated and know they're being recognized. So thank you for your time.
Thank you so much for your testimony. Is there anyone else for or against this bill who'd like to speak? Okay, please come forward. And really appreciate the three chiefs taking time out of their communities to be with us today. The volunteer firefighters across our state really often underappreciated and do so very much for Minnesota. Welcome to the committee.
Madam Chair, committee members, my name is Jim Fisher. I'm with the McDavid Fire Department up on the Iron Range. I'm a township official. I'm also on the state board for townships. But this would be a good thing towards what we have. Volunteerism is a big thing in townships. If some of you I know live in townships, and that's all what we do. We want to make our communities safe and proud for the people living there. And I've been on the department for, I tried to retire at my 31st year. I'm in the 35th year, and I'm still trying to keep the fire department going. And I have to go do work there. There's another fellow with me there. We were going to retire at the same time, and we really couldn't because there's nobody to do what the work that has to be done. So we do it. We have to go and do it. Plus, I was on a national board, and we had a bill similar to this put in on a national board, and it sunset, and we reintroduced it again. But it would really help these people on your retention program that we have in the state to try to keep members, because we reviewed some new members the other day, and we first told them, this is how many hours you're going to do for your EMS and your fire, and they said, no, can't do that. So thank you for your time.
Thank you so much for being here. Appreciate you coming down to talk to us about that. Thank you, Representative Savick. We're going to lay your bill over we're not laying it over because it's in another committee, but we've heard it now informationally, so when we get it from them, we can put it in the omnibus tax bill if the committee chooses to.
Thank you for your time.
Thank you so much. Appreciate it. Representative Grunhagen, I apologize that I hadn't seen you earlier back there, so come on down. And I see Representative Rosenthal made it. We're going to try to ask people to really kind of clip through here because we still have a lot of bills to be done with by 2:00. And, you know, we can come back tonight, but we really would prefer not to. So, Representative Grunhagen, please tell us about your bill. And I think, do we have possession of this one?
Oh, thank you, Madam Chair. Madam Chair, somebody tipped me off in K-12 finance. I can't remember who. If you should read the first time you bring, so I think I will
Okay, so, thank you. And while you're doing that, I'm going to ask if someone will move Representative Grunhagen's bill to get it before the committee. So Representative Ronbeck does that. And then we have two amendments, Representative Ronbeck, that we'd like to get those on for the author as well, if you want to go ahead and move those.
Sure, I'll move the A2.
Okay, so members on the A2, all those in favor say aye. Aye. Opposed say nay. The amendment's adopted. And now Representative Ronbeck moves the A1. Is that right?
Yes.
And now Representative moves the A1 to get it in the order Representative Grunhagen would like it. So all those in favor say aye. 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 Opposed say nay. The A1 is adopted. So your A1, your A2 are on, so we can just discuss the whole bill how you wanted it. Representative Grunhagen.
Hey, thank you, Madam Chair. Say one thing on the candy bars. They are diet candy bars. And the warning on the back says if you eat too many, you're going to need a diet, okay? So be careful how many you take. All right. Yeah, this bill is a cutting-edge reform, and I have Eric Dick here from the MMA, which is supportive of the bill, who I'd like to have testify.
Great. Mr. Dick, welcome to the committee.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Eric Dick, and I am the manager of State Legislative Affairs for the Minnesota Medical Association. Thanks for the opportunity to offer some brief comments. The MMA appreciates the intent of House File 1998. As you know, Minnesota is fortunate to have one of the lowest rates of uninsurance in the country. Minnesota's decision to expand Medicaid, combined with other changes at the federal level, will further drive down the number of people without a source of payment for health care services. Despite these trends, and with up to 200,000 Minnesotans are estimated to remain uninsured, and others will continue to struggle to pay for all their health care needs. Minnesota physicians have demonstrated their commitment in the past and will continue to serve patients regardless of their ability to pay. In 2012, the Minnesota Department of Health reported that Minnesota hospitals provided $117 million in charity care in the year 2008, much of which was generated by services provided by physicians. Minnesota no longer collects and reports physician clinic-level charity care data, but the health department reported in 2000 that Minnesota physician clinics provided $76.9 million in uncompensated care in 1997, the most recent data available. Although this is much broader than just charity care, you can only imagine how that number has grown in 17 years. Minnesota has rightly advanced a variety of policy proposals to reduce the number of Minnesotans that would have to rely on charity care for their health care needs. But as medicine becomes increasingly complex and busy, the MMA appreciates the legislature's exploration of additional ideas that will encourage and incent the provision of charity care in order to meet the health care needs of all Minnesotans. Thanks for your consideration.
Thank you for your testimony. Is there anyone else for or against this bill that would like to testify? No. Okay, Representative Grunhagen, please.
Thank you.
And, you know, we should say, just like we were talking about the volunteer firefighters, really the charitable care is really a great service to Minnesotans and again, often unappreciated by Minnesotans, aren't always aware how much is being offered for no charge. So, Representative Grunhagen.
Thank you for those comments, Madam Chair. Yeah, we have a generous state and generous citizens and professionals here. This particular idea came out of a working group that I was a part of for about 8 to 10 months this past year. The group had doctors, retired doctors, industry experts, and other professionals as a part of it. They believed that this would help incentivize charity care for the poor and the immigrants in some cases, and you'd actually see a reduction in emergency room visits because doctors would have a small incentive. Again, the tax deduction is medical assistance to give charity care. Just give you a couple examples on the dental side. My sister works at the dental office, and a young dentist just bought the practice. She's worked there about 10 or 15 years. He cannot afford to take the medical assistance patients right now because there's a state law that says you have to have 10% of your patients to be medical assistants if you take any at all for a dentist. Well, if he takes 10%, he's going to go out of business. So as a young new dentist trying to buy the practice and pay his staff, he was reported for not taking 10% of his patients for medical assistance, so now he takes none at all. That condition of dentists not taking any new MA or not taking any at all is at a crisis situation in our rural area. I've had confirmation from that from both Republican and DFL legislators. also input from citizens in my district. What this would do, like with the dentist situation, at least a young dentist like that who does want to give charity care from time to time, it would give them a little bit of a tax deduction for providing that charity care. And he would probably take some MA patients on a minimal basis if he could get some type of deduction for it. But the way he's sitting right now, and many of the other dentists in my district, and evidently across the state, especially in the rural area, they're not taking any, which puts patients, especially the elderly and the poor, in a situation where they have to wait for a traveling dental service to come through and hope to be able to get in line for the dental service. So that's basically the idea behind this is... Oh, and by the way, the Minnesota Chiropractic Association has also looked at this bill, and they've given me the permission to use their the name of their association in support of the bill. I would like to call upon Nina at this time to explain the 1099 impact as far as to the actual patients who receive care, if that would be all right, Madam Chair.
Yes, Representative Grunhagen, the key to be a successful tax committee member, if you ever are one, is to rely on health research. So. Nicely
Amen.
Done. Nicely done. Ms. Manzi.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Representative Grunhagen's A2 amendment allows for informational reporting by doctors, dentists, and chiropractors of the amount of charity care they provided and the corresponding Medicaid reimbursement rate that would be allowed as a subtraction under this bill to the Commissioner of Revenue. It doesn't require that informational reporting. When I began working with Representative Grunhagen on this proposal, the term that I think the Mr. Dick maybe used in speaking with Representative Grunhagen about it was to require a 1099. The 1099 is actually an IRS form, so the state would not be able to require that. That's a form that's used for reporting income to individuals. Now, the language in Representative Grunhagen's amendment doesn't require that this informational reporting of the value of the charity care go to the individual who received the charity care. That's something that, of course, could be considered if this moved forward. The sort of then you sort of get into a lot of questions about whether the charity care to the individual is intended to constitute income to the individual and then be taxable and questions like that that would need to be considered.
Great, thank you. Thank you.
Yeah, Madam Chair, sorry for the use of 1099. I'm doing my own taxes this past week, so it just stuck in my head. Okay. Yep. Mm-hmm. But thanks for that comment. Thanks mm-hmm. for your help on that. This bill would need some work going forward, but it's the idea that we're trying to promote here, and I think it would... you know, we've got a fiscal note that we just got before we came up here.
The committee has it as well.
Okay, and it shows 2016, 2017 about $13.8 million, okay? And, as I read the fiscal note over, there's a lot of it is expected, and I think the word assuming's in here four or five times. So there's some assumptions that go in. And let me just say one thing about a fiscal note. You know, there's static and dynamic ways to score fiscal notes. Static assumes that if you receive less revenue, you'll not make it up in some other way. Dynamic assumes that if you receive less revenue, if it's done in a way that can incentivize savings in other areas of the state budget, that you'll actually see a savings. John F. Kennedy was a dynamic economic scorer, and. This is a bipartisan comment, by the way. And Ronald Reagan was a dynamic scorer, okay? Unfortunately, government tends to score things statically, all right? And so I know there's an expense there, but I believe you would see an offset in the type of charity care where people would get it before they'd have an emergency situation or care that they would get that they wouldn't otherwise receive. And we'd see savings in the medical, you know, just one more quick comment. My sister works with the billing with medical assistants and with the insurance companies. And quite frankly, sometimes it is so complicated and confusing, if they could just do the care and take a deduction for it, it'd be much simpler. So I think you'd actually see some reduction in claims by doctors and dentists just deciding to give the care and take a tax deduction for it. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you so much. And thank you for your testimony, Mr. Dick. We're going to lay this over for possible inclusion in the omnibus tax bill. So thanks so much for your time.
Thanks for hearing it, Madam Chair.
Thank you. And so we're going to go to Representative Rosenthal to get through his bill quickly, Representative Rosenthal. And then we're going to move Representative Runbeck up to get through hers quickly so we can have just the angel credit bills left. We still have five bills, members, in 25 minutes. So we're going to ask people to keep it real brief. Representative Rosenthal. And Representative Rosenthal, we don't have possession of this one. This is also stuck in, you know, who are all these chairs who are holding all these tax bills? I need to get them over here. But,
Madam Chair, that'd be jobs.
Okay. So we're not going to move this or your amendment because it's we don't technically have possession. Representative Rosenthal.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members. I'll keep this brief. This is a tax credit for charitable foundations in Edina. We have the Edina Foundations. It's basically to strengthen communities. And instead of wasting your time with my comments, I will turn it over to my testifier, Mr. Tracy.
Thank you. Welcome, Mr. Tracy.
Madam Chair, my name is Bob Tracy. I'm with the Minnesota Council on Foundations. Thank you for the opportunity to waste the community's time with my comments. Minnesota Council of Foundations is a membership organization of 180 foundations throughout the state. What I'm going to do in my comments here is very briefly, first of all, talk a little bit about what community foundations are. These are questions that I've heard from many members of this committee, and I believe that requires some clarification to understand what we're proposing here. Secondly, I'm not going to go through the details of the bill, but to give you a sense of what some of our guiding principles are on this bill. And then finally, just provide a little bit of information about what we know about this program in terms of how it works. But a community foundation is a public charity. Essentially set up as a tool to facilitate the establishment of permanent endowments as community assets. They do that as a service to funders and also to the community. But what you should know is that a community foundation is organized as a 501c3 tax-exempt organization, just like any other nonprofit organization in your community. So what you need to realize is that it is not an independent private foundation. It is not a corporate foundation. It is a nonprofit organization. The other important thing about a community foundation is that it has a specific community or geographic reason, region in which it serves. And so that's one of the reasons why you may find a community foundation to be an appropriate partner for this kind of community and economic development tax credit. A number of members have asked how many community foundations might be eligible for this tax credit. We've been able to identify 27 community foundations around the state that would probably be eligible to apply for this credit. One of the critical elements of their eligibility is that they have been certified by the National Council on Foundations, and you should know that that is a fairly rigorous certification process. We use that certification standard in this bill as a tool to determine eligibility. And finally, you should know what types of community foundations are. Some of you, certainly Representative Paymar is available, is aware of a major community foundation. That would be like the St. Paul Foundation. Independent community foundations, like the Rochester Area Community Foundation, certainly the reference to the Edina Community Foundation, they get classified as independent only because of the reference to their scale. Initiative funds are very different animals for Minnesota. Certainly Representative Marcotte would be aware of the Northwest Initiative Foundation. They are regional in their service, and as part of their mission, have a primary focus on addressing rural economic development. And finally, there are community foundations that have an issue focus, such as Women's Foundation of Minnesota or the Headwaters Foundation. So they focus on particular issue areas, but still are geographically limited to Minnesota. So that concludes the sort of overview I want to give of what community foundations are. I'll slip to the guiding principles of this bill. We want to respect the principle of tax progressivity, so you'll see that we have a cap on the amount of eligible contribution. We also have a 9-month set aside to assure that lower asset donors are able to take advantage of the contribution, and there's first dollar eligibility, at least for a period of time, to introduce lower asset donors to this approach to charitable giving. The second principle is accountability. The credit is sunsetted. That sunset is tied to the 15-year projected generational transfer of wealth that Minnesota is experiencing. And that transfer of wealth is approximately $50 billion. There's an annual limit on the amount of credits of $2 million, and it's a program with a purpose. And that's the last thing we want, a program with measurable impact. That purpose should be to support community and economic development. And therefore, this program is set up within DEED to assure that its results are tied to outcomes of community and economic development. Finally, members should know that there's a similar tax credit in Iowa, Nebraska, Kansas, and Kentucky. Also, North Dakota and Montana, but they are outliers in terms of how they compare to what we're proposing. Iowa is going to be our best teacher on this. I know that's popular for this committee. But Iowa has 10 years of experience and just completed their 10-year evaluation, which was published in January. The one thing I highlight from that evaluation is that they found that 75% of the contributions over the 10 years came from individuals 55 years or older, an indicator that, in fact, it was successful in capturing generational transfer of wealth within the state. With that, I conclude my comments. Madam Chair, thank you for giving us the opportunity to present the bill to you, even though it isn't in the committee yet. We fully recognize that bills like this are introduced as developed ideas, and they find a better path and a better solution as they go through your process. And I look forward to working with the members of the committee and the chair and the leader as we do that. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Tracy, and thank you for the time you spent with me and very many detailed questions, and you knew the answers to all of them, so I appreciate that very much. Is there anyone who'd like to testify for or against this bill that actually is not in our possession, but you may testify? No. Okay. Hearing that, then, thank you so much, Representative Rosenthal. We're going to lay this over, or we're not formally laying it over, but we will consider it for inclusion in the omnibus.
Thank you, Madam Chairman.
Thank you. So, Representative Runbeck, if you can get your folks here, and everybody's been so patient, we appreciate that. We're going to have Representative Runbeck before the Angel Credit bills, because we'll take those together. So Representative Runbeck moves House File 2529. Is it in our possession? Okay, and I think Representative Runbeck, you have an amendment, or am I wrong about that? No amendment. Okay, so the bill is before the committee. Welcome.
Great. Thank you, Madam Chair. And thanks for hearing the bill. Appreciate this opportunity. House File 2529 addresses some issues of families who are dealing with dyslexia and issues of that. And what we're doing is expanding the current educational tax credit in two ways, increasing the credit to $2,000 and also expanding it in a way that it's targeted towards programs that address the dyslexia, and these would be qualified reading programs. And secondly, the bill also adds a credit for teachers who want to gain expertise in teaching a specific dyslexia sort of treatment programs. There's a feature in the bill. This is not meant to double dip with the existing tax credit. And we do have a number of handouts, so hopefully you'll be able to access those as well. But I do have a lot of the credit to this goes to Rachel Berger and a group called Decoding Dyslexia. They've worked very hard. It's been part of a working group this summer, and she'll explain further why this is important.
Well, thank you,
Representative Brombeck.
Welcome.
Dyslexia. They've worked very hard. It's been part of a working group this summer, and she'll explain further why this is important.
Well, thank you,
Representative Brombeck.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Anne, Madam Chair. So I'm going to start out a little differently than you've heard testimony today, but I'll try to be brief here. 45 million Americans are dyslexic. Let me pause and say that number again. 45 million people in the U.S. afflicted with a disability that impacts their ability to read printed words. Why is this number so surprising? Perhaps it's because, unlike other disabilities, dyslexia is invisible. You can't see it, which makes it harder to diagnose, but no less pervasive. And for the millions of children who struggle to read, it's very real and very painful. Many of these children struggle with the shame and the frustration of being ridiculed and dismissed in a world that has yet to understand their disability. They're categorized by teachers, peers, and coaches as lazy, slow, stupid, and not working to their full potential. As a parent of a dyslexic child, it's heartbreaking to watch your once eager, hopeful daughter or son descend into an anxiety-filled pit of despair. Dyslexia scars and bruises on the inside. It eats away self-esteem and confidence. There's a common thread today among among families affected by dyslexia. A child who is loved, a disability that's misunderstood, unidentified, and untreated, and a strong conviction to effect change. We've united to form a collective voice to advocate for all Minnesota children struggling with dyslexia. Decoding Dyslexia is a 45-state parent-led movement driven by families concerned with the limited access to educational interventions for dyslexia within our public schools. We aim to raise dyslexia awareness, empower families to support their children, and inform policymakers on the best practices to identify, remediate, and support students with dyslexia in our public schools. We've been working with legislators on this bipartisan solution since this summer on different goals, and our goals are to establish a universal definition of dyslexia within our state education code, mandatory teacher training, early identification, early intervention, and access to appropriate assistive technology within our general education and special education population. I have with us today a couple of people whom I'd like to introduce to you to speak in favor of this bill and how it affects us.
Great. Thank you. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you,
Madam Chair. Whoever would like to go next. Please.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Jody Stanton. I'm a college student, and I'm also dyslexic. I would like to share with you my personal dyslexic journey. Tuesday, January 10th, 2012, was the day I found hope. That was the day I was diagnosed with dyslexia. I was 25 years old. Up until that point, my life had been a constant battle of fear, anxiety, and low self-esteem. As far back as I can remember, school was a constant source of pain. Even as a first grader, a six-year-old child, I can remember feeling like I was dumb. I can remember working on a color-by-number worksheet, and I didn't understand the concept of matching the number on the page, the color to a number on the page. So I randomly colored the whole page. When I turned in my worksheet, my teacher looked at the paper, then back at me, and what felt like forever, she finally asked me in the most demeaning way possible, "What were you thinking?" I had to lie. My teacher had made me feel ashamed and embarrassed. Unfortunately, this became a theme for me. By fourth grade, my confidence in academics was completely gone. School was a nightmare. I was no longer thinking about trying to finish assignments. Rather, I was thinking about the best way to hide. I didn't want anybody to find out that I was stupid. I never talked in class, not to my peers, not to anybody. I wanted to be invisible. No one can think you're stupid if they don't know you're there. In high school, things got worse. I was cheating on pretty much every assignment. As far as grades were concerned, D's were just fine, and C's were something I celebrated. I was routinely assigned detention because this was a safe place for me. I didn't have to read aloud, and I didn't have to worry about not understanding yet another assignment. I had lowered my own academic standards to the lowest possible point. I cried every day. I hated me, and I hated my life. I longed to be anybody other than me. Junior year was the hardest year academically. I had three different teachers ask me to withdraw from their classes. However, before I dropped these classes, I consulted with my high school guidance counselor. During our meeting, she informed me that I really didn't need the classes. I was failing unless I planned on going to college. It was at that moment that it hit me. They never believed I would go to college, and that decision wasn't even mine to make. It was decided for me that I wasn't college material. So senior year, the expectations were set. As my friends talked about making their college plans, my life was heading in a completely different direction. I had run out of coping mechanisms to deal with so much pain, and I needed to feel good about something. So finally I found something I could feel good about, my weight. I became anorexic. Each pound I lost, each mile I ran, each size I dropped made me feel good. Finally, I was able to accomplish something. Finally, I could feel good about something. On graduation day, most students are celebrating their academic achievements and the beginning of a new and exciting chapter in their lives. I, on the other hand, was celebrating the lowest weight I'd ever gotten down to. Shortly after high school, I started working full-time. I thought that having a job would be less stressful than being in school. I wouldn't have to look or feel dumb. However, that was not the case. What had been haunting me throughout my school years was still a part of my life. I consulted with a family practitioner for help. I hoped for, at the very least, direction and guidance, and I left with a prescription. Finally, after a few years of questioning whether I had a learning disability, I met someone who encouraged me to get tested. I went through the process, and the doctor confirmed I am dyslexic. So there was a reason for my struggle. What a relief. Armed with this new knowledge, I began my journey to learn how to read. I began meeting with a tutor 3 times a week. Each time I walked out that door, I could feel my confidence grow, and each lesson brought me closer to my goal. I started college. I began to thrive. During this year, I began being a mentor for kids who were beaten down like me and struggling in school. One of the biggest things that I've learned is that my story is not unique. There are thousands of people who share my story, and they too just want the help that they need to succeed. In spite of what others have thought me in the past, I will graduate college and I will succeed in life. The schools let me down. I am not stupid, and I shouldn't have had to wait until I was 25 years old to learn that. Thank you.
Thank you very much for your brave testimony, Ms. Stanton. Thank you. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I am Kira Campbell from Rochester, Minnesota. I'm a Minnesota licensed teacher and have worked in the public school system for 15 years. I'm a member of Decoding Dyslexia Minnesota because I have a son who is dyslexic and he has now graduated. I currently work at the Reading Center, Dyslexia Institute of Minnesota in Rochester, and I am an academic language therapist working with young students with dyslexia. And I also work as an infusion coach, where I work with teachers in the classroom, helping them teach reading to students, particularly those who struggle with reading. As a teacher, when I realized my son was having difficulty in school, I felt helpless. Even though I was a licensed teacher, I had no training to specifically help my son with strategies he needed to learn to read. He was getting special ed intervention services, but that did not help improve his learning to read or spell. And I spent hours each night trying to help him. This is the same thing teachers are facing in the classroom now. They are frustrated because they have not been taught or given the tools they need to teach students who are struggling to read or write, our kids with dyslexia. They are not poor teachers, they just don't have the training. We as teachers are not taught the very basic fundamentals of language that would enable us to teach struggling or dyslexic students. We aren't taught that every letter has a sound, for example, the rules of language, language structure, that those things are essential for struggling or dyslexic learners. However, in the meantime, I have received training and I have seen amazing results with not just my students but also teachers using the same approach. For instance, a student that I worked with last year, fourth grader, 125 to 130 IQ, so at a gifted level. He was at a first grade reading level. So again, fourth grader, first grade reading level. Today, he is in fifth grade and he is at fifth grade reading level. There was no improvement with him until he was taught using multisensory instruction with explicit teaching about the structure of language, where he could learn the rules of language so he could use reason and logic to read and spell. This type of teaching is almost non-existent in textbooks today in our classrooms. The same success is seen by other teachers once they have been taught the basic fundamentals of reading, training where they can learn the logic of language and teach to struggling students in a multi-sensory way. This training not only helps teachers learn to teach better, but it helps students learn. A teacher I coached last year, that's another part of my job, I go into the classroom and I help coach teachers to teach in this way. She used this method every day to her students, and every one of her students was at the 90th percentile or above in reading. They hadn't been that way the previous year. Only one was below that, and he was at the high 80th percentile. And he was a special ed student. So all students can learn to read using this approach. The availability of having this tax credit would enable more teachers to get this much-needed training that we were not taught in colleges or universities. Our students who struggle would get the instruction that they need in the schools, or they could, their parents could afford to get the tutoring so they could get this instruction. And it would also be cheaper in the long run because students would no longer need special ed services their entire education career, kindergarten through 12th grade. All students can learn, and all reading levels would increase for all students getting the correct training.
Thank you, Ms. Campbell. I'm going to ask, because we are so short of time, we have three bills to do in 3 minutes after this one, and we're going to ask everybody who's in the audience for this bill, because I'm sure that's what you're here for, to raise your hand so the committee is aware of all the people that took the time. Thank you so much for being here to support this important legislation. Thank you. Is there anyone else who want to testify for or against this bill? I just wanted to make sure folks knew that you you had the room full here, Representative Runbeck. So, there is one more person who wants to quickly come up. Okay, great. If we can switch chairs real quick. We have we never have enough time here at the legislature to do all the great ideas legislators have. Please, welcome to the committee if you want to state your name.
My name is Christine Snyder, and this is Eddie and Henry, and over there is Ian. I am a mother of three children who have been diagnosed with dyslexia. I was a psychology major at St. Olaf, and I did my senior thesis on psychological implications of learning disabilities, focusing specifically on what happens when the needs of children with learning disabilities is not met at school. After college, I worked in special ed in the Hopkins School District, and then I moved on to be a first grade teacher in South St. Paul before I became a stay-at-home parent. I now find myself on the other side of education, a parent outside of the classroom advocating for children with dyslexia. In my experience, dyslexia is rarely understood by educators. It took years to identify my older children as dyslexic. I continually asked the elementary teachers, "Do you think their struggles in reading and writing could be dyslexia?" I was told over and over that I just needed to be patient and eventually my children would learn to read. They were not offered specific help and the schools did not offer to test them. Eventually, we spent $900 for a private assessment for my older children, $1,800 total, and we found out they are dyslexic. When I presented this information to the St. Paul Public Schools, I was told they could not help my oldest child. The principal at our school told me I would need to find a tutor 4 to 5 times a week for 1-hour sessions. Tutors quoted me $50 to $75 an hour. Using $50 an hour and only 4 times a week, that's $200 a week, $800 a month, and $7,200 for 9 months of instruction to teach my one child to read. And I have three dyslexic children.
Thank you so much for your testimony. I appreciate you being here. And thank you, Representative Runbeck. Final words before we lay it over.
It's a popular tax credit, and as you can see, I think we're empowering parents by doing this, and I think that's probably a very, very high goal.
Thank you so much. We're going to lay this over for possible inclusion in the omnibus tax bill. Thank you really all for being here. We appreciate that. And with that, we're going to bring Representative Norton up and Representative Rosenthal to the table. Neither of their bills are here because they are sitting in someone else's committee. So when they get here, and I'm going to go and move mine, and then we'll have all three of the angel bills in front of us. So I'm going to move the bill that we do have, which is mine, House File 2856, to be before the committee. And if members, if that's okay, I want to put my amendments on. So I'll move my A1 amendment. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed say nay. And I'll move my A2 amendment. All those in favor say aye. Opposed say nay. The A1 and A2 are both adopted. So we have the 2856 formally before the committee, and then Representative Norton and Rosenthal can tell us what they're doing with the angels, and then we'll just take public testimony so we can get going here. So Representative Norton.
Very quickly, Madam Chair and members, we have watched and been pleased with some of the successes of the Angel Investment Tax Credit. One of the failures that it's had, and we're not going to have time to get it out to everyone, is that it does not reach rural Minnesota. The Greater Minnesota Caucus has met, and we've met with others. Many of you have heard about this. Only 9% of businesses in rural Minnesota were able to take advantage of the Angel Investment Tax Credit, which is only 6% of the total investments, and we'd like to change that. So my bill just it has three differences from the larger bill, which my colleague right here is going to tell you about. But I would just say the three things it does is broaden it beyond high tech into ag and manufacturing and R&D. The size of the tax credit is greater, 50% rather than 25. It's a much smaller request, so I guess there's four things that are different. And while the existing program requires wages that are 175% of federal poverty guidelines, that's very high for rural Minnesota, and so we're asking for a lesser amount than that. So there's three differences from his. We're hoping you will consider that in your mix so that rural Minnesota can at least have a chance in the coming year to get their hands on a little bit of that Angel Investment Tax Credit money.
Great. Thank you, Representative Norton. Representative Rosenthal, additions on your view of what we should do with the Angel Tax Credit.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members. My bill grows out of the Small Business Caucus that started in 2009. This bill was enacted in 2010 and provided $12 million. And it's been running out of money sooner every year. And we amended it just before to raise it from $12 million to $15 million. Basically, it helps high-tech small businesses that are in their infancy and really need the extra push to get over the first hurdle and really start producing jobs. And once they do that, you see results, as I think the commissioner is here, that start to push the jobs out into rural Minnesota. But there's no question that this credit has helped start a lot of successful businesses in Minnesota, has provided a lot of money in the state. I think $100 million has been a direct effect of this credit, and we would like to see it not only extended, but the amount raised.
Okay, great. Members, these three bills are on the spreadsheet. If you wanted to look at the price tags of the different ones, although with the amendments they change a little bit. I'll just say on mine, I have a Greater Minnesota piece. I have a inside investor component that I want to change how we are allowing such a great percentage of the money to go to the principals and the folks who we would call the insiders in the system. And so, you know, all of these issues are going to be open for discussion for how this committee puts it together. So with that, if and members have all the documentation, I think we should just go to public testimony because I'm pretty sure folks want to talk about most of these bills. So please, welcome to the committee. I have five people signed up, but maybe there's more.
Thank you for yesterday.
And we're going to try to hurry through it because members have to get to the House floor to vote today on things. So welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. My name is Jeff Missling. I'm the founder and CEO of SpineThera. SpineThera is a startup pharmaceutical company based in Eden Prairie, Minnesota. To date, we've raised $480,000, all of it through the Angel Tax Credit Program. I want to quickly share my story with you and my thoughts on how this program can even do more to improve the economy of Minnesota. As a founder of a startup company, everyone is faced with this immense challenge in the beginning, crossing what entrepreneurs call the valley of death. You have a great idea, you've quit your job at a great company to pursue this idea, and you need to raise some money. You need to file a patent application. You need to start the product development process. you need money. In my case, my company is going to need to raise $25 million before our drug has gone through clinical studies that would make it attractive for a larger pharmaceutical company to take it on, or before we could enter into an IPO in the public markets. So I'm going out trying to raise $500,000 to get started, but telling these investors we're going to need $25 million before we get to the end. So you can see how risky an investment like that is. In my case, actually, two-thirds of the money we raised came from Wisconsin. And I think that's an aspect of this program that everyone should understand, is that it's drawing money into the state. It's a refundable tax credit. So when I'm having a conversation with an investor in Boston or San Francisco and some successful ones in Wisconsin, they hear that they can get money back from the state of Minnesota, even though they have no tax liability here. That keeps the conversation going and in many cases allowed me to close the transaction. As Representative Rosenthal said, there's two major issues. First of all, the program is running out of money earlier and earlier every year. In fact, this year it ran out on March 3rd. 4 years ago it ran out in November, then it was July, then it was May, now it was March. If it continues funded at the current level, next year it will run out in 1 week. As fast as Mr. Nelson's office can process the applications, it will be gone. And if we increase the funding to only $15 million this year, I think that amount of money will be gone in a matter of days this year. There's huge demand for this tax credit. I think the reports and the surveys have shown it's creating jobs, it's growing the Minnesota economy. Why not do more of that? That's my personal point of view. And I can tell you today, I've got $750,000 sitting on the table from investors that are waiting to hear what happens with the Angel Tax Credit Program. Now, they haven't said to me they're not going to invest if it's not there, but they're waiting very cautiously to proceed. Many entrepreneurs I know are in the same situation. So I know these things are deliberate processes, but I would ask whatever can be done to decide quickly is really going to benefit our economy and the startup community. My last comment is I totally appreciate the drive to get money into greater Minnesota. But when you're starting a company, you've tapped into your network. Who do you know? Who's going to help you? Most of these high-tech companies are centered in the Twin Cities area, and that's where people need to be. I knew entrepreneurs that wanted to live their dream and start a new medical device company, you know, on a lake in northern Minnesota. Three founders moved up there. They started their company, and they couldn't hire any employees. When they needed a quality engineer, when they needed a manufacturing engineer, when they needed an IT specialist, they couldn't get people to move. So people stick to their core. You stick to your trusted network. In the end, it's better for the whole state to have a high-tech economy, cranking out jobs, paying high wages. I think this is a great program, and I ask the committee and the government to extend it and increase the funding. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony, Mr. Missling. I know you've been in a couple committees on these things today. Welcome to the committee. Please.
Thank you.
Thank you. I'm Julie Gilbert-Newry. I'm the CEO of Precious Status. And Precious Status is an award-winning high-tech company based right in downtown Minneapolis. We are right now deployed across North America in early child care centers, the largest that you can find in the world. We're also working with 32 school districts in Minnesota. And just to put in a little, we were just profiled in this issue of the Minnesota School Boards Association Journal for our work in engaging parents directly in the education, providing real-time updates right here on your mobile phone from teachers. So we're very successful, and we've raised $1.5 million to date. A portion of that came as a result directly of the Minnesota Angel Tax Credit. I can tell you we're right now closing a $3 million round for this company. I was literally just in New York yesterday meeting with investors. They're asking me the question, is there still money left? And unfortunately, there's no money left for them to get an Angel Tax Credit. So I'm hoping, in our original round, I will tell you 90% of the money for this business came out of not only my own personal checkbook, but also out of the checkbooks of out-of-state investors, New York primarily. In this round, the ones that I believe are going to close this round are actually all Minnesota-based. And, you know, unfortunately, there's no credit left. They're waiting to hear what happens as a result of this. Two things I wanted to make a point on is there's actually been a lot of discussion about the jobs that are created. I can tell you for a fact that one thing that's not being looked at, in addition to the jobs that we've created through Precious Status, is we're writing checks of about 25 checks twice a month to contractors. that are providing businesses of their own. We started with a software development firm. The guy rode his bike to the coffee shop to meet with me. He now has a really thriving business, not just because of us. However, we paid him over $200,000 last year, and he's got a thriving business, and he has created 10 or 12 more jobs in the state of Minnesota in downtown Minneapolis. So, and if you asked others, they would tell you the exact same thing. So that's one thing. The second thing that I would tell you is that Minnesota is not really, if you're from New York or the Silicon Valley, the place for high tech. When I go to meet with these investors, I have to basically convince them that we're not tilling the soil here, that there is a high tech community here in Minnesota, and there's employees that are very qualified. And I say that, and it may sound a little harsh. However, in New York, they're saying, why aren't you in New York? And in Silicon Valley, they're saying, will you move to Silicon Valley? Because why aren't you here? And I say I'm in Minnesota because we can get quality workers, and I know that they're going to have an incredible work ethic, and they're going to be passionate about the mission that we're on. And in addition, there's a Minnesota Angel Tax Credit that's going to incentivize you as an investor to want to invest in this company, which is going to be one of the biggest things that have come out of Minnesota. So those are two things I would say. And the third thing I would say is, you know, I spent 18 years in corporate 100 companies, Best Buy, as a senior vice president. I was an entrepreneur there, too, created many businesses. Anyone who questions this should spend one day as an entrepreneur. That's what I would tell you. One day as an entrepreneur and take the amount of challenge, humiliation, and yet you still keep going and you still keep believing in your business and you still keep making sure that you can make payroll every single 2 weeks. So with all that said, I just hope that you'll really consider all of the ramifications of this, all of the jobs that are being created, in addition to the ones that are directly created as a result of this business, and not only refund it, but put a whole bunch more into it. Because it ran out so fast. Thank you.
Thank you so much for your testimony and for sticking around. We appreciate that. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you. My name is Amber Christian, and I am an angel investor. I live in Maple Grove, Minnesota. And thank you very much for having me.
We've done as Arthur, so you're Amber. Okay, thank you.
I am Amber.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you.
Apologies.
Yep. And so I would like to speak a little bit about what it's like to be an angel investor. I am also an entrepreneur. I have my own business as well. So I have a day job, and on the side, I am an angel investor. And I represent a number of angel investors as well. I'm part of Gopher Angels here in Minnesota, a fund that was started up in the last couple of years. And what I would say about the angel tax credit, it's very important as part of the overall investment ecosystem in the state of Minnesota. Because if you look at what we have a tremendous depth of talent in the state. We have wonderful university systems, great cultivators of technology. But this tax credit helps those of us that are willing to invest, but these are really high-risk investments. And so it's very helpful to offset some of that risk. And so for myself, I've invested in software and medical technology companies here in Minnesota, both in the metro area and in St. Cloud, Minnesota. I know I've heard a lot of concern about, is there any investment being done in outstate Minnesota? And I found myself a little surprised because I have invested in an outstate company. So I would say I think it's been a tremendous program, and I hope you will continue to enhance the program as well. As I do think for the entrepreneurs, it makes it challenging because of exactly what the other entrepreneurs have talked about. They have to time their capital raise to the beginning of the year because funds run out so quickly. And so that is something I would ask you to consider as part of your overall bill.
Great. Thank you so much for your testimony. Appreciate you being here. Others? I have Mr. Dorman and Mr. Flaherty. Welcome to the committee. Anyone else? Am I missing someone? Sure. Oh, there's the commissioner. I didn't see you there. So please come forward, all three of you. How about? Did you want to testify too? Please. Yes, please.
Hi. My name is Pramod Hojana. Good afternoon.
Thank you for the committee.
I would like to testify for a medical device company. I used to be a scientist at Boston Scientific, and then I have some idea about how to make the heart attack treatment better. And this is what I brought here quickly, is the catheter that actually going to help patients with heart attack. So what happened quickly is that when the patient have heart attack, when you have stent, actually what we don't know is that the blood that going back to the heart is actually start killing the heart too. So we found that just simply by cooling the heart, it actually can reduce 80% of the tissue death, or in other words, the heart muscle. Anyway, we just did animal study, and we found that we can cool the heart within 2 minutes. This is a lot, like 30 times faster than the current technology in the market, which takes an hour. But what I'm leading to is that this is me who have an idea and actually do R&D in my basement. When I start raising money in 2012, I don't have this, I don't have the story, I don't have the data. So it's very difficult. And also, I didn't have any track record. You know, I was just a pure scientist. So because of Minnesota Angel Tax Program, that's helped me convince the investor who already see the value and believe in the technology but has some hesitant because of the risk. So it's very helpful. And one thing I want to mention, too, is that the majority of my, actually more than 80% of my fund of my funding that I raise is actually come from out of the state. But obviously, more than 80% or even more than 90% of my spending is in Minnesota. So it's actually attracting a lot of funding here. And as you know, that this is the big business, so it will create jobs in the future. And like the previous testifier just said, actually, we already have someone who would like us, you know, to get us to move somewhere or something. But, and, you know, like, commitment with the Minnesota Angel Tax Credit is actually a great excuse for me to give them that, okay, well, please help us, but, you know, we, and does have all the reason to be here. Last thing I want to say is that, well, maybe my story is different from the previous testifier, that this is the capital of medical device in the world, Minnesota. We have Medtronic here. You know, when I started this, I have no idea about business whatsoever. I'm just a pure technical person. Last year, I was invited to present to Dr. Fogarty in California. If you may not know Dr. Fogarty, he is the first guy who invented the catheter to remove clot and change the whole arterial surgery entirely in the 60s. So I was invited to present to the idol of the industry and in Bay Area, and with the guy who doesn't have any business or management background. I was really intimidated, very nervous. But I have to say that because of my mentor, that, you know, that I have, that I've been very fortunate to get, you know, in here. The questions that I got over there was actually not anything that out of, you know, that I haven't been asked before. So we have a lot of talents here. We have a lot of things here. But medical device field has changed significantly since Erbakken started Medtronic. FDA is make it more difficult. Payment is make it more difficult. The risk is more. So that's why the program like Angel Tax Credit would be very helpful. And the fact that I'm here in Minnesota in the Twin City, I want to advocate that a little bit. You know, we didn't raise a lot of money at all. Actually, my number is not the number that you heard. I raised in 2012 75,000, just 75,000. Half of that go to the patents. I built a system to cool the heart that we did in the animal study for only $10,000. And that's because I got a lot of help from my friends, from the, you know, actually most of them are people that I just knew through this network. And because I'm in the metro area, you know, they can just stop by after their work at 4, you know, hang out at my house, you know. This catheter, the first one, this one actually I make it by my own hand, but the first one that we made, the cost to make this is a two pan of noodles that I cook for the guy. So, I mean, the point here is that we have a lot of people here that can help. We have, you know, in business, you want to find something that you have all the ingredients and just one missing link that is missing, right? You don't want to build everything. And that's what my last thing to say is that's what we are here, especially for medical device. We have a lot of things. We have the big company. My last animal study, I got donation from Medtronic, so it's reduced a lot of costs for my animal study. Minnesota Angel Tax Credit would be one of the mechanics to fill that missing link. Thank you very much for the opportunity.
Thank you so much for being here. We appreciate that very much. Thank you. Commissioner, welcome to the committee, and we've got former Representative Dorman and Mr. Flaherty, so why don't we start with the commissioner. I didn't see you there. We had you on the list, but I didn't see you, so apologize for that.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. I'm delighted to be here with you today. Governor Dayton has recommended $15 million per year in funding for the Angel Tax Credit Program. The legislature passed and indeed launched the Angel Tax Credit Program in July of 2010 to encourage private investments in high technology startups, particularly software, medical device, and biotechnology firms. Since it started, the Angel Tax Credit Program has facilitated more than $212 million in investments to Minnesota startups since it was launched in July of 2010. Since its inception, the program has made 767 business certifications, as well as certifying 2,160 investors and 82 funds. And there is great demand for this program, as you heard. Demand for credits has far outstripped the amount available for them every year since the program began, and this year we were fully exhausted by March. I'd like to just remind you, heard from entrepreneurs today, the majority of businesses that benefit from this program have one or two employees. They are raising funding for Series A round anywhere from $300,000 up to $3 million. This is our one state-funded program to really focus on innovation, entrepreneurs. How are we supporting and spurring new innovation across our state? We know not every one of these startups is going to succeed, but we do hope that some of them become the next Medtronic or 3M and grow to significant job creation numbers. The Department of Revenue recently completed a study of this program that was conducted by the Economic Development Research Group. As I mentioned, it's attracted $212 million in private investments and supported an average of 512 jobs at Minnesota startup firms from 2010 to 2012. And that number is expected to climb to an average of 635 jobs from 2013 to 2020. And again, remembering these are companies that have one or two employees, so it will take time until we see significant job numbers. But we do also know that the report found 571 indirect jobs in contract workers, consultants, agency staffers were created in 2013 as a result of this program. We also know that there's been great activity in the Twin Cities metropolitan region with this program. Our high-tech industry in the state is primarily focused in this region of our state, and so that's why we're seeing more activity here. But we're aware that as these businesses grow, they start to expand to other regions in greater Minnesota, and we're aware that 34 businesses have already identified locations outside of the Twin Cities area as they need additional square footage and other resources as their business grows. So I'll be brief considering the time, but just thank you for your time today.
Thank you, Commissioner. And we apologize that this has run over, but remember, everybody should know that we're going to hear the governor's tax bill next week, and part of the discussion, again, will be the angel, and we'll be taking public testimony, so people may want to interface with us on the angel in the governor's proposal, as the commissioner just went through on that day as well. So thank you so much for being here, Commissioner. We appreciate it. Representative Dorman or Mr. Flaherty, who would like to tell us your thoughts, I'm sure, on the greater Minnesota mix of the angel credit?
Thank you, Madam Chair, and the remaining members of the committee. I appreciate the opportunity to speak to you. My name is Dan Dorman. Today I'm representing the Greater Minnesota Partnership, which is an organization of, we've got 70 members throughout the state of chambers of commerce, EDAs, private businesses that are interested in trying to spur economic development throughout Greater Minnesota. In listening to some of the testifiers, I thought we had a challenge, but it sounds like it's bigger than I thought. It's, you can't go out to Greater Minnesota and do some of these things. That was kind of disheartening to hear that, but we're going to correct that. I think we're optimistic, and as we look at the, if I go back to my legislative days, a couple times I carried a venture capital bill before it got narrowed. It was just trying to get more venture capital into the state of Minnesota, because we have a shortage of venture capital, I think, not just in Greater Minnesota, but in all of Minnesota, but particularly acute in Greater Minnesota. And I think the testifiers before sort of made our case that they feel like they have to be in the metropolitan area for a variety of reasons, and we want to see some of that growth get out into Greater Minnesota. I think the track record so far in this program, over 90% of the dollars have went to firms inside the metro area. Representative Norton, we think, has a good solution to and really doesn't impact that program. We do support the Angel Investor Program. Works great in the metropolitan area. We just think we need some different tools in Greater Minnesota, and both would be a good thing. So in order to be brief, Madam Chair, we support Representative Norton's bill. We think that will spur job creation in greater Minnesota, and there is an interest for metropolitan legislators as well. Moody's, one of the bond rating agencies that the state uses, in their report from October of 2013, highlights several concerns. They were optimistic overall about Minnesota, but two of their concerns revolved around the growing disparity of the economy between the metropolitan and non-metropolitan area, and that the job growth that has started since the Great Recession ended has most of the new jobs have been in the metropolitan area. That should be a concern for everybody, not just folks from greater Minnesota. So, Madam Chair, thank you for the opportunity to be here today and be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. And again, I apologize that we're down to this,
no apology,
this skeleton crew, but I will tell you, when we take up the governor's, well, whatever we are.
You got the important.
You know, when we take up the governor's, though, we'll start with the angel. When we get to the public testimony on the governor's tax bill, we'll start with the angel then again, so you can give it, you know, to the full committee again, because he does have a greater Minnesota component, and we'll be hearing that whole piece from the Commissioner of Revenue that day. So, Mr. Flaherty, thank you for waiting.
No problem. Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Tim Flaherty. I'm representing the Coalition of Greater Minnesota Cities, which is 85 cities outside the metro area. Just wanted to give you a quick history. Back in 2002, before there was any credits in the state for venture capital, we noticed that there was the venture capital that was coming to the state was all in the Twin Cities. Very, very little of it was coming to Greater Minnesota back then. We proposed an angel investment credit program just for out there to see if we couldn't attract some private investment to Greater Minnesota for startup businesses. 2003, it actually passed in the House Omnibus Tax Bill. In 2000, and it didn't pass in the Senate. In 2004, it passed in the Senate Omnibus Tax Bill and didn't pass in the House. And so in 2005, Governor Plenty proposed it, but just in the Job Z areas, and so that passed in the House and the Senate. They passed the angel investment for Greater Minnesota, but they were opposed to having it applied just in Job Z, so it didn't come out of the conference committee. So we've been talking about this a long time, and we want to give it a try. It's much harder to get angel investment money in Greater Minnesota. We know that. That's why we think the Norton bill really addresses the reasons why it's not coming out there. And that's based on some of the discussions I've had with businesses out there and economic development professionals. And we can talk more about that at another time. But that's kind of the history of it, which we think is important. We're not asking for everything here. We think a $5 million appropriation and changing the parameters a bit. We think we have good universities, good entrepreneurs, good people with innovation, and we think with the credit that might actually help get some more startup businesses going out there. So that's kind of the pitch.
Okay, great. Thank you. And I know from talking to members, you two have done a great job of talking to people one-on-one on how important this is to you. So thank you for being here. I appreciate it very much.
Thank you. We appreciate the time.
Thank you. Further testimony? I think you're last. Or is there someone else? You're last. Okay.
Madam Chair, being last, I will be quick because I know you all.
And I apologize again. Also feel free to come, and we'll start with you guys first on the governor's tax bill.
Appreciate that. Thank you, Madam Chair. Shay Mandel with Life Science Alliance again. We represent a host of these early stage companies. I think you're familiar with our organization and what we do. So I'll just make a couple quick comments. This is an amazing program. As you see, the number of businesses that received investment in 2013 was double what it was in 2010. I mentioned to you earlier a report that Life Science Alley has done showing that in this period of time, we've gone from $217 million of investment in life science companies to $341 million, also part of this program. So we're very supportive. What we would suggest is please, as we make this program more attractive to other regions and other types of businesses, which we are supportive of, we just also want to make sure that we're not cutting back on what has demonstrated real job growth thus far. So add a lot more money to the program. Please don't cut the program in the places that it's proven to be successful. And with that, I'll thank the committee for your time.
Thank you so much for waiting, and we appreciate it.
And Representative Paymar, are you willing to move the minutes for March 11th and 12th?
So move it.
Okay, so all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, say nay. The minutes are adopted. With that, we're adjourned. Thank you, everybody.